Father, Son, the Holy Spirit, one God, Amen. Honestly, it's I who is thankful to Abuna Yunen and Abuna James for giving me the opportunity to come here. And I never dreamed or imagined Yani to be Fikinist al-Adra in this capacity. It's something مش دخل عقلي, and it's I can't get it into my mind Yani to be here. It's very humbling Yani to be here, and it's a real joy Yani to be with all of you. And definitely Houston was our home for 10 years, and we still consider it home, and we still consider everyone here to be our brothers and sisters. That's a blessing, honestly, to be back and to be in your midst. We send you, of course, the greetings of the family. They wish they could be here and to see all of you, but the circumstances didn't permit. School starts next week in San Antonio. They have to meet the teachers, Malish. That's the circumstances. Thank you, of course, Abuna Yunen, Abuna James, for giving me this opportunity. I hope, Yani, we should have some slides, God willing, coming up soon. And I'm just trying to fill time. But God willing, Yani, Abuna Yunen, as you mentioned, will talk about this this concept of being content or contentedness, according to the verse in Philippians, which St. Paul wrote, I have learned in whatever state I am to be content. And Yani, to adjust our thinking about this concept of contentedness, it's useful first to take a look at St. Paul and what were the circumstances when he wrote this verse, that I learned in all circumstances in whatever state I am to be content. This is a verse, as we all know, from Philippians. Philippians is one of the four prison epistles that St. Paul wrote when he was imprisoned in Rome. And as we know, of course, that St. Paul was imprisoned twice in Rome. This was during the first imprisonment. And although it wasn't as harsh as the second imprisonment ultimately led to his martyrdom. But yet, this was a man that did not have his freedom to move and to go about. This was a man who had some uncertainty about the circumstances coming up. I mean, when he was in prison, although he was relatively treated in the first imprisonment relatively well, and we read in Acts that he was in his own rented home and he was able to see visitors, those who came to him, and he was able to write and send letters. But still, he was living in a state of uncertainty. Yani, his life was at the whim of Caesar, and yet in this condition, he said, I have learned in whatever state I am to be content, to be satisfied. So definitely, if somebody is in this circumstance and he's talking about being content in any state, in any condition, certainly his understanding of what it is to be content must be different than our understanding of what it is to be content. There are times I'm not content with what I have for dinner. If I'm in prison, Yani, how can I be content? So it's useful for us to consider here. Which one do I push? Oh, it's not. Okay. It's useful for us to then re-examine our understanding of what it means to be content. What does this concept of being content mean? So we'll discuss a little bit this definition of this idea of contentedness. And then we'll look at some examples from the Bible of people, both those who were discontent and those who were content, and see that probably the circumstances surrounding their discontentedness or their contentedness is also rooted in this different understanding of what it means to be content. And then we'll look into this idea of being content in more details. Specifically, what are some sources of being discontent? Why do we become discontent in our lives? And what are some sources of being content? And we'll look at these in the context of the seven deadly sins and their contrary virtues. The seven virtues that are contrary to the seven deadly sins. As we know, there are seven deadly sins. We'll review them, Yani, as we go through the discussion. And each of those deadly sins has an opposing or an opposite virtue. And so we'll look at this idea of contentedness and discontentedness, and discontentedness as being a manifestation of one of the deadly sins, and contentedness being a manifestation of the contrary or the opposing virtue to that deadly sin. And hopefully this will provide us some tools when we start to see that we're getting discontent in our life, some tools to diagnose perhaps the source of the discontentedness and understand how we can adjust our perspective and adjust our outlook to move from being discontent to being content. May God provide us a word and some wisdom. First of all, let's understand the idea of contentedness. What does it mean to be content? If we look at the dictionary definition of the word content, it is to be in a state of peaceful happiness. To be in a state of peaceful happiness. This is an internal state. Notice that the definition of being content relates to the internal state of the individual, not to the external circumstances. Contentedness is an internal state, not an external circumstance. And if we acknowledge and recognize that that contentedness is an internal state, this realization, the acceptance of this reality, loosens for us the keys to discontentedness and contentedness. Why? Because implicitly, if I believe that my contentedness, my satisfaction is tied to the external circumstances, then I have no control over my state of being content or not being content, because it's tied to the external circumstances over which I have little to no control. But if I acknowledge and recognize that being content has to do with my internal state is within my control regardless of the external circumstances. I can make a conscious decision to be content regardless of the external circumstances. And therefore, I have freedom. I'm not bound by the circumstances. The circumstances don't dictate my state. Rather, I see the circumstances and I recognize and acknowledge that the circumstances are something outside of me. And my contentedness is a state which is in my control. It is in my hands. It's a decision. It's a choice. And this is why St. Paul can say that I have learned in whatever state I am in to be content. He's distinguishing here between an external state when he says in whatever state I am, in whatever condition, in whatever circumstances I find myself in, I have learned how to be content. So when he says state, he's referring to the external circumstances. When he says I have learned to be content, he's talking about his internal condition, his internal state. So he's learned in whatever external circumstance, in whatever external condition, internally, to be satisfied and at peace. And this must give us a hint then that his understanding of contentedness and circumstances and what's going on around him and how it influences his internal state, perhaps, I can't speak of others, but certainly is different than my understanding, because so many times I can allow the external conditions to penetrate inside of me. With this understanding, let's recognize or acknowledge that perhaps one of the large contributors to being discontent or dissatisfied is unmet expectations. When I have an expectation of what the outside world should be like, when I have an expectation of what the circumstances should be, and what happens isn't consistent with my expectation, what happens around me, the circumstances I find myself in, are different than what I was expecting or what I was planning, then I can become dissatisfied or discontent. This can be a major source of discontent. Certainly there can be others, but let's recognize that one of the major drivers of discontentedness is when I have unmet expectations. If we take a simple equation, I was an engineer not so long ago. I was an engineer, I was an equations person. So if we put together a small equation here, discontentment or the degree of discontentment is simply the difference between what I want and what I have, right? This is to be discontent. If I want a certain amount and what I have is less than what I want, then I see this difference. Why? This is not meeting my expectations. I need to come up with a way to bring what I have up to what I want. And so then I pursue, okay, what's wrong here? Why is it that I don't have what I expect to have, or what I want to have, or what I desire to have? Or depending on my perspective, I may say what I need to have. Because sometimes we allow our wants to be defined in our mind as needs. Although it's not something I need, but because I want it so much and I desire it so much, internally it feels as if it's a need. Okay? And so oftentimes, most frequently, when we find ourselves in a pattern of being discontent, this pattern of discontentment comes because I can't lift up what I have to what I want. And I focus on lifting up what I have to what I want. But if I look at this equation, there are two ways to reduce this discontentment. I can try to increase what I have, and I may or may not be able to increase what I have. But by the way, as I increase what I have, typically, and this is a pattern that often we'll see in life, as I increase what I have, what I want increases, and it increases more, right? So as I struggle and work hard to increase what I have, I think that I'll be content because I've set what I want, and I'm increasing what I have to reach what I want. Great, so I'll be content when what I have reaches what I want. But unfortunately, typically what happens, as I increase what I have, I start to notice other things that I don't have. And I begin to want more. And what I want often grows at a rate that's much greater than the growth of what I have. So understanding this pattern when I look at it, actually increasing what I have is not going to decrease discontentment. Rather, it's more likely going to increase my level of discontentment. It can happen. I won't say that it happens all the time, but it can happen in this pattern. And so if we look at this, perhaps we need to adjust, rather than working on the side of the equation of what I have, maybe we need to adjust and work on what I want. Okay? And this is kind of the trend we'll look at. Let's look at a few examples from the Bible. This is a picture of two people that we know from the Bible. One of them is Ahab, who was the king of Israel. He was arguably, maybe not even arguably, probably inarguably, the worst king of Israel of all of the history of Israel. The man was a disaster. He established the worship of idols and destroyed the worship of the true God throughout the nation. And perhaps Elijah and one or two others were maybe the only righteous people kind of found around his time. There were very few righteous people found in his time. And the other man is a man by the name of Naboth. Naboth was a simple man in Israel. He happened to have a vineyard, a small vineyard, which was close to the palace of the king. And this was his inheritance from his father. And we know, of course, in the Old Testament, in the time of the Israelites, the parental inheritance, particularly the land that the people inherited from their families, was a very important inheritance. It was something that they held and passed to their children, and it was their association with their tribe as the people of God, as the children of Abraham, who was given a promise that he would inherit, his children would be a great nation, and he would inherit the promised land. So it was not something light or easy for the Israelites to give up their inheritance. And so Ahab saw this vineyard of Naboth, and he desired it. And he went to the man and told him, "Let me have this vineyard." And Naboth said, "Although you're the king, really I can't part with the inheritance of my father." Now Ahab was the king of all Israel. He was rich. He had so much in terms of what he had and what he owned, and probably any piece of land besides this one. Many of the people of Israel, he could have asked just about anything he wanted, and he would have been able to receive. But although he had all of this, when his request to Naboth was refused, we see his reaction. So Ahab went into his house sullen and displeased. Sullen is like with a very down countenance, like depressed. And when we see his behavior, it's the behavior of somebody who is depressed. He was sullen and displeased because of the word which Naboth the Jezreelite had spoken to him, for he had said, I will not give you the inheritance of my fathers. And he laid down in his bed and turned away his face and would not eat food. Although this was a man in the kingdom who had effectively everything, right? The king of Israel was a rich individual, right? He had everything. But because he couldn't fulfill this desire of having this small piece of land, which was the inheritance of this man, he fell into a depression, not only a discontentedness, like not only was he dissatisfied with his condition, he became depressed, he refused to eat, he could not find any joy in anything else, to the point that the queen saw him and said, what is this? It's not befitting for the king of Israel to be in this manner over a small piece of land. What do you want? And then they cooked up a plan to kill the man and steal from him the vineyard. This was Ahab's way of dealing with his discontentedness. So we can see here that it emphasizes the point to us that having everything, he had all the power in Israel, he had all the wealth in Israel, he had the position, he had the role, he had the obedience of the people, he had so much as the king of Israel, and yet this didn't bring him contentedness. A small piece of land that belonged to a common man in Israel caused him to fall into discontentment and depression. We see also discontentedness among the people of Israel. Putting this in context, the people of Israel were slaves in Egypt. God freed them from Egypt with a mighty hand. He freed them from Pharaoh. He allowed them to pass over the Red Sea. He allowed them to wander in the wilderness. While they're in the wilderness, he gave them water from a rock when they were complaining that they were going to die of thirst. We have the picture here. And he gave them manna from heaven. Imagine if you woke up every morning and your food was ready on the ground. You didn't have to toil, work, anything. You just pick up what you need and bake it, cook it however you want, and eat. And this was consistent every day. Okay? And this was a heavenly food coming directly from God. And yet, in this circumstance, we find that the people of Israel were not content even with the provision of God that he provided for them on a daily basis, for which they didn't have to labor. So the children of Israel also wept again and said, who will give us meat to eat? We remember the fish which we ate freely. Okay, it's interesting to use that, which we ate freely, although they were slaves in Egypt. And now, while they are free and they're being provided food from heaven by God, their discontent and longing, what they want is the fish and the cucumbers and the melons. So clearly we can see that their perception of what it means to be free is completely skewed, right? The fish which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, all that's missing is the ful. Yani they missed the ful and the ta'amiyya and the atz that they ate in Egypt, right? But now our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all, and now this word, except this manna before our eyes. Their discontentment got to the point that they despised the provision that God was providing. Something that we can evaluate. Sometimes also we fall into the same fault or the same sin that we look at everything that God gave us and we say, yeah, all we have, the only thing I have is this, right? Which is what God provided, right? So again, it tells us that perhaps we need to readjust our perspective to understand discontentment. Let's look at a positive example. Here's a man, of course, all we know him and all of the kids know him. They learn in Tant Imen's Sunday school class, right? And all of the Sunday school teachers teach this story about Zacchaeus, right? Who was a tax collector. Then we know his story. He climbed up the tree and he saw Christ and he refused everything that he had and all of his wealth. He gave it up and gave to the poor. And this word, Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, look, Lord, I give half of my goods to the poor, and if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold. And of course, we learn that first he gave to the poor, and then out of what was left, he restored the debt that he owed. He didn't even say, I'm going to restore the debt, and if there's anything left, I'll give half of what's left to the poor. No, he gave to the poor first, and then restored. If there was anything left, he would live. Why do I say this? This man was a tax collector, and he abused his position, he abused his authority to steal from the people, right? By his own admission, if I have taken anything from anyone by false accusation, which shows that he was never content, and he kept seeking more and more and more, and took more from the people by sinful gain, and he was not satisfied and he was not content. When did he become content? When was he really satisfied? When he met Christ, he changed his perspective. He realized that his sins were forgiven, and he recognized that everything he was pursuing was vain, was worthless. And he was so satisfied to give to the poor and to restore the debt that he owed to the people that he owed by false accusation. This made him content. This made him content. He found contentment when he found Christ and when he readjusted his perspective of what's valuable, what's worth having, what's worth pursuing, and what's worthless. Right? Everything that he was pursuing for his whole life, he saw as worthless and joyfully gave it up and joyfully gave it back after his encounter with Christ. So these examples help us readjust our perspective of what it is to be content and what it takes to be content. So now, as we discussed, we'll look at how in our lives discontentment can be a manifestation of the seven deadly sins that we've heard about and we read about and we learn about, and how we can adjust our perspective if we identify that perhaps our root of discontentment is lying in one of those sins. How can we adjust our perspective, and how can we work on the contrasting virtue to try and build up the contrasting virtue in our life and become content by cultivating virtue in our life and struggling to remove sin from our life. So we can see in one instance discontentedness as pride. How do I mean discontentedness as pride, manifesting itself as the its root is pride in my life? This comes out when I believe that I'm entitled to something. Or even worse, when I believe that God owes me something, that I've done something and God owes me because of who I am or what I did. This is pride in my life. And when I see that I don't get the thing that I believe I'm entitled to, or worse, I don't get the thing that I believe that God owes me, I'm dissatisfied because what I have doesn't match with what I want. This is an important thing to keep in mind when we're raising our children, and the importance and the influence of being able to set boundaries for our children and tell them no. And no, not just because I said so. Maybe they're desiring something that's not sinful, but if they're accustomed to abundance and always receiving what they want, they don't know how to manage when they grow old this impulse or this desire, because they're used that every time they have a desire, it's fulfilled. So sometimes it's perfectly reasonable to tell our children, no, you can't have what you want. Why? There's nothing wrong with what you want. And at some point, maybe you'll have it. But you've had enough. You got so many. You have so many toys. You had so many treats. You had so much time playing on the phone, so much time watching TV. You had so much time to play with your friends outside. This is enough. Let's wait. No, why? Because this is enough. Perhaps some of you recall a few years ago there was this case that was quite widely publicized in the media about the affluenza teen. This was a young man, I guess he was in Dallas, and he went and he was drinking and he caused a car accident and killed people. And his lawyer's defense in front of the judge was that this poor youth of, I think he was 17 or 18 at the time, this poor youth, 17, I think he was tried as a juvenile, even. This poor youth at the time, it's not his fault. He's a poor victim of his circumstances. Why? His parents always gave him what he wanted. So he never learned to control his impulses and distinguish. And they came up with this expression, affluenza. Right? It's an illness. This poor youth was a victim. He had an illness of not being able to control his impulses. He was too rich and his parents never taught him how to restrain what he wants. He was always entitled to whatever he wanted, he got. And so he shouldn't be held accountable for this. Malouj Zemb, he doesn't have any fault in the matter. How can we address this? Remember what St. Paul told the Corinthians. Who makes you differ from another? And what do you have that you did not receive? Now, if you did indeed receive it, why do you boast as if you had not received it? God is a loving God. He gives us anything that we receive from God is because of God's goodness, not because of our worthiness. So why do we boast? And beyond boasting, why do we think that God owes us anything? God does not owe us anything. God does not owe us anything. We owe him everything. Which then brings us to the understanding of the contrary virtue. If we recognize this, we can work on the contrary virtue, which is humility. The contrary virtue to pride, pride is the vice or the sin. The contrary virtue is humility. Humility is not about looking down at the floor and taking the last place in line, right? Perhaps this is a manifestation of what is humility. But in simple terms, humility is to know who God is and know who I am. And to know who I am in front of God. If I recognize God and his goodness, and I recognize my unworthiness, I'll never tell him, you owe me. What am I? I'm but dust of the ground, right? You created me, you restored me, you bought me for a price, you adopted me, you prepared for me a place in your kingdom. You gave me breath, you gave me everything that is in me. What more can God owe me? Anything even that I feel I earned through what God gave me, even if I think I earned anything. And who are you? You are the creator of the world. You are the savior of mankind. You are the Pantokrator, the Almighty. You are the provider of every good thing. Who are you and who am I? And who am I saying you owe me? Right? And we can see this satisfaction of being in the presence of God when I recognize who he is and I recognize who I am. My contentedness, my satisfaction will be in being in his presence. Just knowing that he's there will be a source of comfort and satisfaction. This will be my contentedness. This will be my joy because I know who he is. If I have an audience in front of the king, and not only I have an audience in front of him, but I can call him Father. I can cry out and he hears me and he silences the heavens to hear my supplication. What more could I want than this, right? So when I recognize who God is, I recognize who I am in front of him, I'll find my satisfaction. And this is what was said to Martha in reference to Mary. Martha was working and struggling. What she was doing was good, was noble. She wanted to serve the Lord in her way. This is not something condemned. But the response was, one thing is needed, right? The thing that is needed is to sit at the feet of Christ and enjoy his presence. And Mary has chosen the better part, which shall not be taken away from her. Mary has chosen the better part, which shall not be taken away from her. We can see also that discontentedness can manifest itself in my life as the two sins, gluttony and lust. I lump these together. Why? Because gluttony and lust are both related to unhealthy appetites. They're both related to unhealthy appetites. Gluttony most commonly is referred to requiring or needing or wanting an excess of food, but can be really, and if we add to it the pride of life or the desire to acquire, to keep acquiring in a gluttonous way, material things. The unhealthy or the abnormal appetite for gaining material things. And lust, of course, is related to an unhealthy bodily appetite also, right? So when we have these unhealthy appetites, it's related to always wanting more. Nothing is sufficient. This, I notice, is manifested the most notably and most obviously in our society today in cell phones. How many times do you buy a new cell phone and then within a week you start looking to find out when the new model is going to come out, right? Like, the iPhone X comes out, and before you even open the box, you're trying to figure out when the next iPhone whatever, and what's it going to be called, and what are going to be the features, and how much better is the camera? I mean, the newness of the phone that's in your pocket still hasn't worn off. Like, you're able to surf the internet fast. Like, it's just the only thing that's missing an implant in your brain so your phone knows what you want, and Google's working on that. Like, it's popping up with things before you know you want it. It's telling you want it. And yet our appetite for the new next gadget, the new thing is coming up. All right. Some people, maybe it's fashion, the next fashionable thing. I buy a pair of shoes and before I even get out of the house, I'm wondering, okay, what's the next pair? Can I get this one in red or green or purple or orange, whatever is the next thing that's coming, right? This is also rooted in this push in our society for immediate gratification. Okay, I need more. Why? Because I try something now. Oh, I'm delighted, right? I'm so satisfied with it. But soon that enjoyment wears off. Okay, I'm used to this enjoyment. I need to search for the next enjoyment, the next thrill, the next thing that makes me happy, the next thing that gives me that excitement and feeling of newness. And this then reaches to excessiveness. And this is rooted in our focus on seeking other sources, false sources of happiness. I try to seek happiness or comfort or contentedness or joy from food, from things, from wealth, from other people. And then as this need for immediate gratification grows, and as my wealth increases, sometimes it goes then to perverse needs, right? And we see that people fall into sins like alcoholism and drug abuse and other perversions because they're continuously desiring to satisfy that need for more. They keep trying to get more, acquire more, that gluttony and that lust that's driving them to seek more. And they seek more in false sources of happiness, false sources of joy, not in the true source of joy, which is, of course, Christ. We can put in front of this the verse that tells us, and having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptation and the snare. And after this is where we hear the very well-known verse, which is often misquoted, by the way, for the love of money is the source of all kinds of evil. We often say, money is the root of all evil, right? This is the way we remember it. But actually the verse says, the love of money is the root of all kinds of evil. Paul says this to distinguish that, okay, if God in his wisdom, in his providence, provides for somebody to be wealthy, we shouldn't look at this and despise them and say that this must inherently be a sinful man. There are plenty of examples of people in the Bible and in the church history who were righteous and yet wealthy. Job was wealthy but righteous. Abraham was wealthy but righteous, and others. So there's not a disconnect between righteousness and wealth. God can provide wealth to somebody because he sees that this is suitable for that person's salvation, and this is in his wisdom and his providence. But the unhealthy desire or drive to be rich and continuously seek more can be a temptation and a snare. Again, it's about what I want, not so much about what I have. I should reduce what I want. If God provides more, I can accept it thankfully and remember where it came from, and I don't cling to it as my source of joy or security, but I cling to God, who is the provider of every good thing. We can put from this, across from this, the contrasting virtues of temperance and chastity. Temperance, I mean moderation in all things. And chastity, which is temperance of another bodily lust or desire, right? Modesty and moderation in what I'm lusting after, right? These virtues teach us the idea of delayed gratification, that I work and I struggle in this life and I'm seeking a gratification later, the reward that's to come, not the immediate reward that comes from a lustful desire or a gluttonous desire. Temperance and moderation and chastity come from well-defined objectives or goals. If I have a clear objective that my goal is to reach the heavenly kingdom and to work and struggle with God to help as many people along the way as I can to also attain their salvation and reach the heavenly kingdom and build a relationship with God. If this is my goal, then I won't be distracted of the glittering things that are at the side of the path. I have a clear path. I have a clear objective. The shining things on the side of the path are not going to distract me because I have a goal in mind. So I'll be moderate. I won't lustfully and gluttonously try to gather the things along the way that appear to be a source of happiness because I have the true source of contentment in front of me. And I have a heavenly goal. As St. Paul says to us, And everyone who competes for the prize, that has a clear goal in front of their eyes, who competes for the prize, is temperate in all things, is moderate in all things, because they realize that excessiveness will hinder them in reaching their goal. You find that athletes, serious athletes, can be very disciplined, very disciplined in what they eat and how they exercise and when they wake up and when they sleep. And they monitor all of these things very carefully, right? Because they have a clear objective, they have a clear prize, a clear goal, they're temperate. They don't eat excessively, they don't refrain from eating excessively. They don't seek things that can serve as a hindrance or a distraction from their goal. And you'll see in the world of athletics, as soon as they start getting distracted and indulging in those lustful and gluttonous desires, this so often is the downfall of very successful athletes. You see in the news, they end up in trouble, they end up in jail, they end up rejected by their team, they end up losing sight of the goal. So it is also in our spiritual struggle. So if we find that our dissatisfaction is rooted in a desire for more and unhealthy desires for worldly things, we can moderate this with the virtues of temperance and chastity. Discontentedness manifesting itself in our lives as a root cause of envy, particularly this idea of keeping up with the Joneses that's so common in our society now. I buy a house and the first thing I have to do is wait until there's an open house somewhere in the neighborhood to make sure that my house is nicer than the other houses in the neighborhood, right? The neighbors buy a new BMW, a new Lexus, a new Mercedes. I have to go buy a model higher. Oh, what does yours have? Oh, you didn't get the navigation system. Why not? Right? This idea of keeping up with the people. I see what they have and what I have should always be better, right? I see what they have and I desire what they have. Why? Just because they have it and I want to have the same thing. I want to have more or better or nicer, right? Here we have to recognize in our society today the influence that social media plays in feeding this sin that of envy and which is a root cause of a lot of dissatisfaction. When I spend, I start to say, okay, let me look at whatever, Insta, Twitter, or Facegram, or whatever, right? These, all of the different social media platforms, I can't keep up, right? That was deliberate, I know. It's Facebook and Instagram and Twitter. It was, okay. But when I look at this, and I always see what people are posting, the pictures from the last vacation, or the experience at the mall, or the pictures of the new car, or the kid's birthday party, or the new house, or whatever. The things that people are posting, I see this, and it's continuously bombarding the back of my eyeballs, right? It's like imprinted on my retina, and I'm always seeing people posting how happy they are and how they've achieved their fitness goals for 2019, 6 months before the end of the year, and now they have this, I'm going to reward myself by taking a cruise around the world. And other people post, this is what they post. I see this. This feeds this envy, right? I see what they have. Why them, right? Why them and why not me? What are they doing that I'm not doing, right? What are they doing that I'm not doing? You know what they're doing that you're not doing? Posting on Facebook. That's what they're doing that you're not doing, right? They're posting everything on Facebook. Okay, if they didn't post everything on Facebook, you'd be satisfied and content and everybody would be happy, right? They don't post it, you don't see it, right? You hear about it when you meet them, you build a real relationship, and that's it, right? Let's keep in mind also that rarely do we see other people's struggles. Often, we see the things that, we see what they want us to see, right? We see the image that they portray on social media. But we don't know, when we see the house across the street, it's nicer than our house, it's bigger than our house, it's fancier than our house, it's flashier than our house. Maybe inside, there's a sick child. Maybe inside, there's a broken family. Maybe inside, there are spouses that they don't talk to each other. Maybe there's an addiction that can't be overcome. right? Maybe there's a family that humbly lifts up their hands in prayer every day and every night, and God sees that the way for their salvation is this, and the way for your salvation is different. We don't see inside, right? We don't see the struggles and the extent to which people are struggling with and what they're struggling with, right? Sometimes if we remind ourselves of that, oh, I wish I had, when I say I wish I had, think about really if you'd be willing to take the whole package. Or if you just wish that you had the pieces that you see, right? Because maybe if you take the whole package, you can't bear the other pieces of the package. And that's why God is giving you this and giving them this. We don't know. We don't know. If we keep this in mind, that we don't know what's going on, we only see a piece of the picture, but God sees the whole picture, and in His providence and His wisdom, He gives or He allows to happen, so be it. Right? If we put in front of our eyes this verse, when we think of envy, finally, all of you be of one mind, having compassion for one another, love as brothers, be tender-hearted, be courteous, that you may inherit a blessing. Then I remember that the success and the joy and the wealth of my brother is my success and joy and wealth. And I'll rejoice with those who are rejoicing. And I'll mourn with those who are mourning. Why does it cause me anxiety or discontentedness or sadness or depression when I see that someone I love is blessed by God in one way or another? Right? Then I won't look at what they have, but rather I'll rejoice for what they received. And I'll say here a word that I learned from Abuna Yunan. I'll say it in Arabic and then I'll translate it. He said, خَلِّ حِسَابَكْ مَعَ رَبِّنَا. Keep your account with God. Don't try to seek from others or places. Just look at God. Okay. If I have what I need from you, I'm content. Whatever you give, I'm satisfied with. Keep your account with God. Don't look at what others have. We can put across from envy the contrasting virtue of kindness. Envy is seeing what others have and wanting it, right? Wanting it for myself. Kindness is seeing what I have and wanting it for others. How can I give the good things that I have to others? Okay? And in this regards, let me look at what's of real value that I have, and how can I find out to give it to others? Specifically here, how can I share what I have for their salvation? Whether it's the word that I have that they didn't receive, whether it's the beauty of the church that I have, that I know, that I received, that they didn't have the opportunity to see, and maybe God is giving me an opportunity to minister for them and to be a step along the path of their salvation. Or maybe it's the things that I have that they need that I can give to them and let them feel that this didn't come from me, but God provided it for them through me so that they draw closer to Him. And we can see this also in the same book when St. Paul talks about contentedness in Philippians. He said, but I want you to know, brethren, that the things which happened to me have actually turned out for the furtherance of the gospel. This is a man who's imprisoned and who's under guard, and he says that the guards are not hindering the spread of the gospel, and that the brethren have confidence when they see that although he's in prison, he has the opportunity to preach. So he saw that his circumstances were actually for the spreading of the gospel, and for the encouragement of others, and for the salvation of others. This is kindness at its root, that I'm willing to accept suffering for the sake of others, right? So I can look, if the root of discontentedness in my life is envy, that I always see what others have and want it, let me look at what God has given me and how can I share it with others for the sake of their salvation. And this will be a good ointment to treat the sin of envy that leads to discontentedness. What about discontentedness manifesting itself in my life as greed, clinging to things? And particularly, I'll speak about clinging to what I had that I lost. What was in my hand, I had an opportunity and I missed it. I had wealth and I lost it because I was pursuing a godly pursuit, and then God took this away from me, right? You can look at Lot's wife, that she had her eyes always to the back. Perhaps it was lust in her case, but also sometimes we look behind out of greed, that I want to gain what's ahead without sacrificing what I had, and I don't want to leave anything behind. This is part of the wisdom also of the church in teaching us fasting so that we know how to give things up. Fasting is a remedy against gluttony, it's a remedy against lust, it's a remedy against greed. In her wisdom, the church gives us fasting. It's a treasure and a gem, right? It teaches us to sacrifice, to give up things, that it's okay. Why? For the pursuit of more important things, right? St. Paul then teaches us, but one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind and reaching forward to those things which are ahead. Sib idak shwaya, loosen your grip a little bit on the things that you have so you can reach forward for the things that are truly valuable, right? If I'm clinging to greed, and it can be greed for money, it can be greed for time, it can be greed for so many different things, greed for success, greed for the opinion of people, right? We can be greedy for so many different things, but if we're clinging and hanging on to things, unwilling to let go, right? This can be a hindrance and we can be discontent. Why? Because as soon as God sees that I need to let go of something, and whether by my will or against my will, if it's against my will and He forces me or causes me to lose the grip on something that I'm holding dearly, this will manifest itself as not just discontentment, but resentment and so many other things. That how could you take this from me? Right? But then we look at Job, who had so much. He was like the richest man among those that were alive at the time. And his word to his wife when she told him, depending on the translation that you read, either bless God and die or curse God and die, right? His response was, shall we receive blessing from God and not cursing, right? Do we receive good things, right? The Lord gives and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord, right? He wasn't clinging to things. He didn't have a greedy desire to hang on to things. And because of that, God restored him and restored him double in what he had. The contrary virtue is charity, right? Greed is clinging to things. Charity is giving freely, right? Greed is to want to take. Charity is to want to give, right? Then I'll be content in using what I have to fulfill the sufficiency of others. When I see that God has given me something for the purpose of distributing it to His children and therefore planting worldly things and reaping heavenly things, then I'll be satisfied and content in a way that I can't be by clinging to what I have. When I count all things as rubbish for the sake of Christ, as St. Paul also says, for I've counted all things rubbish for the sake of Christ, right? And I remember the words of Christ Himself, whatever you do to the least of my brethren, you do to me, right? When I keep these ideas in mind, that what I have is worthless compared to the souls that I can win for Christ by distributing these things, and that Christ sees when I give of what He gave me, that this is an action that I'm doing directly to Him and for Him through His children. This will help me overcome this idea of greed and clinging to things in my life. Then I won't be discontent because I don't have what I used to have, but I'll be content because I'm doing the work of the Lord and using His provision for the sake of satisfying His children. And this will give me satisfaction. We look at the early church in the first days of the church in Acts. We read, nor was there anyone among them who lacked, for all who were possessors of lands or houses sold them, brought the proceeds of the things that were sold, and laid them at the apostles' feet, and they distributed to each as anyone had need. this idea of brotherly love, of kindness, of charity, giving, gave people satisfaction. And we see then the contrary vice when Ananias and Sapphira were clinging to what they had and tried to deceptively fool the disciples and the Holy Spirit. We saw their end because they were clinging to what they had. They weren't giving with a free hand. They were being dishonest and trying to deceive and give an image of charity when really what was in their heart was greed. See, discontentedness manifesting itself in my life as sloth, laziness. When I get lazy in my relationship with Christ, this can lead to discontentedness. Why? Because there in each of us is a gap, a void in our life that's the exact size and shape of God, right? That only He can fulfill. When I get lazy in building my relationship with Him, this hole becomes so obvious in front of my eyes, manifests itself in front of my face clearly as a desire. From inside, it's a desire for God. I am desiring what I can only get and can only be fulfilled by a relationship, an intimate, true relationship with Christ Himself. When I don't recognize this, when I relax in building that intimate relationship with Christ, when I relax particularly in my spiritual canon that I agreed on with my confession father, I cease to grow spiritually. I cease to grow in that personal, intimate relationship with Christ. That need manifests in itself in my life. And I feel discontent. I feel dissatisfied. I feel like something is missing. What was the root that I got lazy in my relationship with Christ? I got lazy in my spiritual canon, right? And oftentimes then this can lead to seeking satisfaction through other means, through other channels, in other directions. I put across from this the verse, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shadow of turning. Rather than seeking the gift, I should seek the source of the gift. And He'll provide the gifts. And actually, if I'm satisfied in my relationship with the one who gives the gifts, then wanting the gifts is not even going to be, my desire is not going to be for the gifts. My perspective will shift. Right? Can I find contentedness in diligence? The satisfaction of a job well done, that I've worked and I'm ready to hear the words. I hear the words of God. Well done, good and faithful servant. This is what I need. I'm satisfied. I've been faithful in what was put in front of me, and I have my satisfaction. I have my joy from building my relationship with Him. This is sufficient. I labor and I work and I struggle to know Him better, and this gives me peace and joy and comfort and happiness. I don't have any expectation of reward. I don't have any expectation that God is going to reward me for anything. The reward is the relationship. If God provides anything else, this is out of His providence and His wisdom. He sees that it's useful and beneficial for my salvation. I put across from this the verse, so likewise you, when you have done all of those things, so you have been diligent until the end, you have done all of those things which you are commanded, say we are unprofitable servants. We have done what was our duty to do. I worked, I labored, I did what was in my service to do, what God gave me as a responsibility, both in establishing my relationship with Him, and then as that grows in preaching Him to others and laboring for the sake of His kingdom, I did everything. And I did what was mine to do. I was responsible, I was diligent until the end. And I'm satisfied with where I am and what I have in my relationship with God. Whatever God provides after this is His grace. It's not anything earned. Then discontentedness manifesting itself in my life as wrath. This comes about when I have unmet expectations, when I work and I struggle and I'm diligent and I try hard and I feel like I'm not getting. The outcomes are not what I expect. This comes when I take a responsibility for the outcomes and I feel like somehow I'm responsible for the fruit of my labor, not my effort. Also, I'll borrow from Abuna Yunan what we learned from him, that we're not responsible for the fruit. The fruit is God's responsibility. We're responsible for the labor, for the effort that's put in front of us to do. If we're diligent in what we're supposed to do, if we don't feel like we see the fruits or the outcome of our labor, we shouldn't get upset, angry, dejected, discontent, despondent. Pick any negative attribute that you want to fill in the blank. No, we should be satisfied that I did what was mine to do. The fruit is God's, whatever He provides. So if the outcomes, okay, the kids in Sunday school are not learning what I think they should learn, they're not growing the way I think they should grow, my spiritual life is not growing the way I see it should grow, although I'm doing what I should do, somehow I don't feel like I'm getting the reward from God. As long as I'm diligent and following up my spiritual guide, I should be content that I'm fulfilling my responsibility. God will provide comfort. God will provide the reward in His time and in His providence. We can put across from this St. Paul's words, I planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. I shouldn't be upset or angry or disappointed or wrathful or have any negative feeling that I'm not getting what I should have, right? Also, if I'm not treated the way I should be treated, this is in God's providence. The contrasting virtue is love. So we look at love as contrasting to wrath in the way perhaps that we're more familiar with, that I'll find my contentment when there's peace among the brethren. If there is peace, I'll labor and work hard to build this peace and preserve this peace, godly peace. I mean, not ungodly peace, right? Sinners can be at peace with each other as well, but I'm looking for godly peace, right? And I recognize that love suffers, okay? So if I labor and I struggle and I work and I'm diligent and it's returned to me by evil things from those who I'm trying to serve, okay, I'm willing to suffer out of love. It's kind. Love does not envy. And we know the rest of chapter 13 of 1 Corinthians, all of the attributes of love. We see this in the image here of Abraham and Lot, right? Abraham saw that the need for grazing land for the herds was causing a contention among his herdsmen and the herdsmen of Lot. And he said, it's not right. We're brethren. We shouldn't contend with one another. So Abram said to Lot, please let there be no strife between you and me and between my herdsmen and your herdsmen, for we are brethren. He didn't care at all for the good land. He cared to maintain the peace and the relationship with his nephew, not even his, but he called him his brother. Right? We are brethren. And so he said to him, you choose the land. If you go to the left, I'll go to the right. Choose what you want. Okay? Although, as the elder, by every means, he could have said, I'm going to take the good grazing land, and you go over there. You have your place, I have my place, and we're satisfied. And that's it. No. He cared about the peace between the brothers more than having the good peace. And God rewarded, and we know Lot chose the better land near Sodom, and we know the outcome of that. So, in summary, we can see that contentment can come from managing our expectations, what I want and what I perceive that I need, rather than what I have. If I can decrease my needs and wants, I can be more content. True contentedness comes from Christ. And discontentedness comes from pursuing worldly things. This will be the case. This will be the case. If you have everything in the world and you don't have Christ, you'll never be content. If you have Christ and you have nothing from the world, you'll be content. Discontentedness can manifest itself. It can be as a manifestation of the seven deadly sins in our lives. And so if we recognize the source, we can identify the contrasting virtue and try to grow this in my life and work on this to address the root of discontentedness in my life. And glory be to God forever. Amen.